Alan, would you like to reserve a portion of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 5 minutes.
All right. You have it. And before you start, Mr. Murphy, are you taking the full 15 minutes, or is Mr. Keeling also going to argue?
Judge, I'm only going to take about 1 minute.
Okay. All right. You all may divide that as you your 15 minutes as you see fit.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. All right, Mr. Hayden, you may proceed when you're ready.
Your Honor, Virginia Code Section 8.01-271.1 requires every pleading, motion, and other paper that's filed with the court to be signed by an attorney authorized to practice law in the Commonwealth of Virginia, subject to an exception set forth in Virginia Code Section 16.1-260 and a second exception set forth in Virginia Code Section 63.2-1901, both of which were not applicable to this case at bar. Nothing in the language of Virginia Code Section 8.01-271.1 or Rule 1:4C permits a person other than a licensed attorney to sign a pleading on behalf of an unrepresented party. You either have to be a pro se petitioner acting on behalf of your person, or
I hate to interrupt you so early in your argument. Are you familiar with this court's decision in Rudolph versus City of Newport News?
I guess I'm not. No, Your Honor. I do not think that I am. However, I cited various cases of the Court of Appeals that had been decided that supported the city's position. However, I don't think it gets around the fact that the Virginia Supreme Court has repeatedly and very emphatically in repeated cases stated there is this requirement that pleadings be signed by an attorney. Now, the city attorney notes in their brief that, 16.1-260 was amended effective July 1st, 2016 to specifically authorize persons, social workers for the Department of Social Services to sign these pleadings even though they're not attorneys. But that merely highlights the fact that when these petitions were filed back in 2014, there was no such law in effect authorizing their signing. It merely highlights the fact that prior to July 1st of 2016, no non-attorney social worker could sign these attorneys and these pleadings and really have filed a proper pleading. As the Supreme Court repeatedly noted in cases like the Aguilera versus Christian case, the Scheich versus Hunter case, the Coney versus Wilson case, and there's several others that are cited there, the Supreme Court has repeatedly held that a pleading signed only by a person acting in a representative capacity who is not licensed to practice law in Virginia is a nullity. That's the ruling, and I think that's dispositive of this case, right? On that basis,
Mr. Hayden, may I interrupt you?
Yes, ma'am.
I think we understand, your argument, but in the Rudolph case, which was the Rudolph versus City of Newport News, I think that case, I was on the panel, but I think it was offered by Judge Beals, and that case specifically dealt with this issue, and it specifically stated that it was fine to move forward, and I think the Supreme Court, an unpublished opinion in Barnhart, also dismissed an appeal where that was an issue, if I'm not mistaken. So I understand your argument on that, and maybe we're wrong and maybe you're right, but right now we have that case law standing. So if you want to move on to your next argument, we're
yes,
happy
ma'am.
To receive it.
I note that the policy of the General Assembly that's been expressed, it was expressed in the Weaver case of the Virginia Supreme Court, noted that the The preservation of the family, and in particular the parent-child relationship, is an important goal, not only for the parents, but for the government itself. And statutes terminating the legal relationship between parent and child should be interpreted consistently with the governmental objective of preserving, when possible, the parent-child relationship. I would respectfully submit that that policy was not adhered to in this case. In this case, when we think about the unusual nature of was this a circumstance of a broken family where a parent was imprisoned? No, we have this two-parent couple, married couple, a long-term married relationship with four children who've had their parental rights terminated on the basis of apparently...
No question, Mr. Hayden, any sort of termination of parental rights is an awful step to have to take, and all of our case law and statutes listed as essentially a last resort. But can I go to your second assignment of error and ask you about on the motion to quash? My sense is you're saying, look, HIPAA doesn't allow this information to be shared. But isn't there exceptions to the requirements for privacy under HIPAA? And didn't, when she indicated that she was willing to go through this process, didn't she indicate through her original signatures that she was willing to be evaluated as to her mental health because that was an issue in this matter? And if that's the case, if she then changed providers for the counseling and refused to sign the consent form after that, what other method does the court essentially have in order to protect her as well as the children to make sure that she's either making really good progress and there's not a problem or there is a problem?
Well, I think they had access to the records, but what they wanted to do was go on a fishing expedition to get the records subpoenaed to bring into court with just a general assertion that we need mental health records, and hopefully they find something.
Initially, they agreed that they would sign over and turn over all of the medical records because mm-hmm. they were at issue, because they were ordered to do this. And so how are you indicating it's a fishing expedition for them to get
for the purposes of this termination of parental rights, where there's no allegation that the mother was suffering from some, or the father either for that matter, suffering from mental illness that was impeding their ability to parent, that just wasn't the case. The mere fact that you have a termination of parental rights proceeding to just issue a carte blanche, well, we're seeking all mental health records just because, you know, this is a termination of parental rights case, it doesn't automatically come in. I think it's my weakest argument, and that's why I didn't intend to argue it at all on this point, because, arguably it might be an issue if the statute basically says in the judge's discretion he can choose to allow it in, and he did in this case. I don't think it was relevant, but in any event, that's what the judge did. So I would acknowledge that that's probably my weakest of the three arguments. But we have here a circumstance where a family has had the parental rights terminated, married, two-parent family, long-standing marriage, stable marriage, and you think, well, was it some issue of a parent was imprisoned to have it? No felony convictions. Was it some issue of they had some mental health issue, psychiatric incarceration or suicide attempts or something of that, a drug addiction or something? No, wasn't that. Was it some horrible crime that had been committed that was just irreparable? You know, they'd beaten and tortured the child, locked them up in a cage, or the kind of things that were, if it happens one time, that should never be allowed to happen again. No. What we have here is a circumstance of a single slap with a child that the father acknowledged was wrong. He should not have done it. He withheld the fact that he did it from the mother. But they blame the mother for saying she didn't apologize or confess or admit to having knowledge of this thing. They blame her for that and as a failure to accept responsibility when she doesn't know about it.
But isn't there all sorts of other evidence in the record for the trier of fact here to review with regard to their watching sexually explicit movies while the father was unclothed and activity that both the mother and the father did during the sexually explicit movies in addition to physical?
All unconfirmed. There were no founded sexual abuse allegations. There were never even so much as there was no conviction, certainly, not even so much as a charge being placed against anyone related to any sex offenses. The sex offenses or the unusual masturbatory behavior of the one child, not all four children, was only observed more after a child had already been in foster care for more than 13 months after she was abused by a foster care parent in foster care. And that is certainly an explanation why the parents would not.
Mr. Hayden, Judge Malvin wants to ask you a question.
Let me just stop you there. There was no proof that that was something that happened in foster care. That was an allegation that the mother made. Would that be more statement of the facts?
And it's accurate to state that the city failed to prove their case that there was any connection whatsoever between the alleged observed masturbatory activity of the child and the...
No, sir. That's not my question. And if I'm being unclear, I apologize. Here's my question. I just want to clarify the record. If I understand correctly, you're indicating that the alleged abuse occurred in foster care. However, the record doesn't bear that out. The record is where the mother suggests that could have happened there. Would that be a more accurate
That was what she attributed that to. But the bottom line is, it was never established what the source of this masturbatory behavior was on the part of that child. And sometimes children masturbate. That sometimes happens. Sometimes children look at the internet, see things, and get exposed and sexualized that way. It doesn't mean that the parents did something wrong. You have to assume that the parents do it. You need proof, and that's clearly what is absent in this case. What they did prove was a single instance of slapping. And so then the parents signed a safety
plan. Just
want
to let you know you're injured.
Thank you. Parents signed a safety plan, agreeing not to do any further use of corporal punishment. They acknowledged that they'd done that in the past, but they said, we agreed not to do it, and there was zero evidence that they'd failed to adhere to comply with that requirement of the safety plan. Zero evidence. So that was the thing that led to the children being placed in foster care. They had substantially remedied by signing the foster care plan and proceeding to do all the things that were asked for of them in Dr. Kilday's parental capacity evaluation and the 11 recommendations in the foster care plan. When Ms. Collinsworth, the social worker, is asked to cite a single thing that the parents had failed to do in the foster care plan or the recommendations set forth in Dr. Gilday's report, she was unable to cite a single thing. She acknowledged the Houstons had cooperated and completed all the recommendations. She said, quote, they did not decline to do any service that was requested of them. And so I'm asking her specifically a single thing that they failed to do here or a single service that they refused to receive. She was unable to name anything. When I asked the same question of Christina Rowley to name which of the 11 recommendations in the foster care plan or the 10 recommendations in the parental capacity evaluation that they had refused to participate in or comply with, she, too, was unable to name a single one. So is this... We're going to terminate the parental rights of two-parent family, long-standing relationship. Nothing, no drug addiction, no incarceration, or not as parents that have the financial capacity. On the basis of a single slap, that occurs outside the mother's presence, she's unaware of. When she finally does become aware of it, she's very upset about that. But they took appropriate steps. They did everything. The situation that led to the children's placement in foster care, which was the slapping, a single incident of slapping, it was remedied. They signed the safety care plan. They adhered to it. They followed all the recommendations. And yet we're terminating parental rights in this case. That's not adhering to the policy of fulfilling the policy of this General Assembly of respecting the parent-child relationship, not terminating except in the most extreme cases. That policy wasn't adhered to. I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Hayden. All right, Mr. Murphy.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Patrick Murphy, and I represent the City of Newport News Department of Human Services. Before I begin, I just wanted to note that the department and the guardian ad litem has filed a motion to dismiss in this matter, and if that were to be granted, it would be dispositive in this case. However, the assignments of error that are brought forward by Mr. Hayden and in his brief are mainly in respect to the termination of parental rights cases, and so I'll address those now. Starting with...
And can you start off, your time will go very quickly here, we find, so I'm going to hate to interrupt you at the beginning, but can you start off by addressing the points that Mr. Hayden just made, and that is that, and certainly this board has said, that termination of parental rights is a drastic resort, and it is usually a last resort. And so can you address the arguments that he just made, particularly with regard to assignment of error 3 and the fact that he says that basically this is based on a single slap involving a two-parent married couple who've been married for a long time?
Yes, Your Honor. Part of the things that the agency was looking for in moving forward the goal of reunification, which was the initial goal in this case, was to reunify the children with their parents, was that there be an understanding of the events that led to the children's placement and continuation of placement in foster care, as well as reduction of the risk to the children for future abuse. They engaged the Houstons in services. There was a parental capacity evaluation done that bared out.
Talk a little bit more about the initial removal and what started this. I understand your argument is the Houstons would do certain things and then we wouldn't hear from them for months. And then they'd do parenting classes and anger management classes. And then, again, we'd have a period where there wasn't much contact.
Yes, Your Honor. My understanding of the initial removal is that there was an allegation of abuse towards one of the children, and that was deemed to be founded, and he was found to be in abuse and neglected condition, and the other three children were found to be at risk of abuse and neglect based on that adjudication. Therefore, there was a plan put in place to move forward, to try to attempt to reunify and to reduce the risk from this ever happening again, and that it would be a safe household for the children to return to. Part of the concern of the agency was the lack of insight and understanding that was shown by the parents, and I think that was also bared out in Dr. Gilday's reports of how the children came into foster care, as well as what needed to be done to reduce the risk to these children should they be reunified. I believe one of the statements in the record is that in an initial meeting, Ms. Houston indicated that the children were in foster care because they were poor. So there clearly was some lack of insight that was shown by the parents as to why their children were in foster care. That's why the services were put in place and the recommendations were made as they were, to try to help them gain that insight, to help them listen to what their children are saying. I think the record bears out that there was a discrepancy of how the children characterized life in the home versus how the parents characterized life in the home, and that whether or not they were listening and validating what their children were saying about how they viewed life in the home in order to reduce the risk factors. And that's why...
But you really haven't answered my question. My question is, what caused this in the first place? And then did certain other things happen as they were trying to resolve it that led to additional concerns by the department that then... I mean, I asked the question of Mr. Hayden of the sexual situations that were occurring, supposedly, in the record. How much of this caused the department to either change what it thought, or was this... his point is none of this was ever founded. So address that for me, would you please?
Yes, Your Honor. As we were moving towards reunification, there were several additional CPS complaints that came forward. I think one was originally in May of 2014, and visitation was suspended. Then it was that investigation was took place, and it was deemed to be unfounded. They resumed visitation for a time. Then several additional CPS complaints came forward. While those were testified to be unfounded and no criminal charges were brought, it's difficult to speculate why a CPS investigation is unfounded or why criminal charges would not have been brought. However, the fact that the CPS allegations were being made and the children were disclosing certain things was a concern to the agency and led to the elevated risk factor going up. It was something that the agency would need to have further engaged the parent and more reason the parents to engage in the services that were provided by the agency. The fact that we had these additional CPS allegations come in, and then right about the same time, the parents kind of drop off the radar was very concerning to the agency. They wanted to continue to engage the parents, even though visitation, rightfully so, was suspended during the CPS investigations. But the parents did not engage with them. Ms. Hollingsworth, the family engagement specialist, reached out to them, even went to their house, she testified to. Never got a contact back. Ms. Riley reached out to them. Letters were sent. I know the CASA worker reached out to them in various ways. That period of being between approximately September 2014 and December 2014. And eventually they did re-engage with the agency, but I believe it was after they maybe had received notes of a family partnership meeting that they were invited to that they didn't attend, where the goal was being recommended to be changed to adoption. But even then, the agency gave them the opportunity to engage in services. So it was a totality of the situation that the agency was looking at.
Counsel, may I interrupt you just for a moment? I mean, ultimately, as I've read this case, your position would have to be, based upon the testimony and the reports, that really there was never any real progress because the parents never acknowledged the problem. And, of course, the problem being that the type of abuse was considered to be a spanking, which was in the mouth, a hit in the mouth, a strike in the mouth, and there never was any substantial, according to your clients, there never was any substantial acknowledgement or changes in the way that they would handle those things.
Yes, Your Honor.
Throughout, it seems like a lot of services were offered, and they did participate some, but the position of the department was that they never made it to the finish line.
Yes, Your Honor, and as Ms. Hollingsworth and I believe Ms. Riley testified to at trial, is that it's more than simply checking boxes. It's showing insight and progress. The recommendations of the department, the services in place, and the recommendations of Dr. Gilday, they're means to the end, but they're not the end in itself. Simply going to classes and participating in these things is not enough to make that substantial progress. They actually have to show the progress, their tools to get there. And that was not shown, and that's why the agency sought termination of parental rights in these cases.
Did the children also testify, or were there records that were admitted without objection that showed that the children stated that they had been abused, physically abused?
I believe that's in some of the foster care plans, yes, Your Honor. The children did not testify in any of the court proceedings.
No, I'm aware of that. However, those came in without objection.
Yes, Your Honor.
My reading of the record.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the court can consider that, of
yes,
course.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's in the record.
Yes, Your Honor. And as I was mentioning, in these cases, the case law is that the decision of the trial court should not be disturbed unless it is plainly wrong and or without sufficient evidence to support it. And the record is filled with reasons why the trial court made the decision and evidence that supports this decision. I'll go back to something that Mr. Hayden said about a question that was he asked of Ms. Hollingsworth about. You're not taking directly out of the transcript. The question was, you are not able to name a particular thing they failed to follow through, failed to do, or refused to do prior to September 2014. Is that correct? And she said they did not decline to any service that was requested of them. That was before September 2014. Obviously, the record bears out that they dropped off the map around September 2014 and no longer had communication with the agency for approximately a three-month period. So I wanted to address that discrepancy.
Counsel, I want you to address something else for me, if you would, please. Maybe I misunderstood you, and perhaps I'm wrong, but the standard on a termination case is what?
It's an abuse of discretion, Your Honor.
Abuse of discretion on a termination case?
Yes, if the trial court should be, decision should not
be. What is the standard for the trial court to adjudicate termination of?
Clear and convincing evidence, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Clear and convincing evidence. And the court found by clear and convincing evidence that the Houstons, Ms. Houston in particular, did not substantially remedy the circumstances that led to the children's placement or continuation in foster care. I think in that continuation in foster care phrase is key because that is related to the insight that needs to be shown by the parents.
There was, if you could just also, or perhaps the guardian ad litem could address the fact that the two older children, while not having reached the age of 14 at the time of this, were getting close to that, and particularly the oldest one, and yet there was nothing that they weren't brought into court and asked, what would you like? Although I think Judge Fisher found that with the oldest, if she had been brought in, given some of the things she said, she would have said she absolutely did not want to go back based on what he said in, as he made his ruling. But can you address that for a moment, or the guardian ad litem, one of you?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll attempt to address it as best I could. That issue was raised at the trial court. In fact, the counsel for appellant attempted to state that it was the city's responsibility to bring the children in and establish that fact. While no such burden exists on the department under the law to bring the children in, there was no evidence to suggest other than what was provided in brief, I believe, by the appellant, that the children, after a visitation with their parents, that they seemed remorseful that the visitation was over and were connected to their parents. And that was in relation to Dr. Gilday's evaluation, which happened in March of 2014, several years before we went to trial on this. There was evidence to the fact that I believe Ms. Hollingsworth testified that the older child had written, "I do not want to go home," on one of her arms. And so there was, if anything, the evidence bears out that the children did not want to go home and are comfortable with where they're at with their aunt and uncle in that situation. So that issue was raised. Judge Fisher considered it. And he made the finding that they were not of an age of discretion nor objecting to the termination. It's even on the order that he entered that day. And, Your Honor, just to briefly address the other two assignments of error, as the court mentioned, the Rudolph case, we obviously would contend that any petitions that were filed in this case by non-attorney social workers are valid. There was multiple petitions filed in this case throughout the litigation. Generally, the practice is that these cases start off with an emergency petition for emergency removal, which is the social worker goes down.
I hate to interrupt you, Mr. Murphy, but if you want Mr. Keeling to have his minute, then you might want to
wrap
up quickly.
Yes, Your Honor. We would just ask the court to affirm the circuit court's decision. Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Warren Keeling, and I'm the guardian ad litem for the children. To answer one of the first questions, when you look at the foster care plans, it wasn't a mere slap. The child had a concussion and was not taken for medical treatment for at least a day, perhaps longer. That was the initial reason for the removal by Judge Logsdon. So we clear that up. The other thing, I think Judge Fisher, it was point made it out, they weren't drugs, this, that, or the other. But Judge Fisher pointed out it's not the magnitude of the problem, it's the ability of the parents to correct it. And over two and a half years longer that the department gave them, they didn't have to give them that time, but they offered that to them. So, I mean, the court just ruled that they just, you know, the best interest of the children was to terminate the rights. Were there any other questions the court had regarding that?
Can you also address the issue of the two oldest children and why some inquiry shouldn't have been made of what they would prefer to do here?
They did not want to go home. And it's, of course, the guardian has the option of bringing them to court, but I rarely bring a child to court on a proceeding like this. Although if the parents wanted to subpoena the children and demonstrate that evidence, you know, they had the option of making that motion with the court. But, you know, they weren't 14, so we didn't have that problem. And then to speculate on the emotional maturity, they'd been through a lot of transitions, so they were not in a position to make an informed decision to their best interest, if that answers the court's question.
It does. Any further questions for Mr. Keeling?
Thank you. Right.
Thank you, Mr. Keeling. Mr. Hayden, I think you have 1 second. But I'll give you a minute because we had a lot of questions for you.
Thank you. I would submit the Deal case is controlling, that the trial court's failure to consider the wish of a child who's reached an age of discretion is a grounds for reversal. There was no evidence that they, that despite the assertion that they had didn't want to return to parents, there's no evidence of that. And they simply weren't asked, and to just presume that they weren't of an age of discretion in the absence of any evidence isn't what the Deal case calls for either. The evidence that was adduced was Dr. Gilday noted the children seemed to be generally attached to their parents and exhibited seemingly genuine sadness when their visits with the parents were over, and that she saw no evidence of fear or terror on the part of children when they were with their parents, a genuine close attachment. And yet we don't ask those the 12 and 13 year olds, do you want to have your rights to your parents terminated forever? We don't even ask them, and that did not appear. To simply presume they couldn't have been of an age of discretion in the absence of any evidence. I didn't subpoena them into court. I know that if I try to do that, subpoena children into a termination case, I know I'm the judge. What are you doing dragging these poor children into the courtroom under these stressful circumstances? I'm reluctant to do it. But the burden is on the city to establish that they aren't of an age of discretion or that their wishes are, in fact, to terminate the parental rights. And they didn't have any evidence adduced for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hayden. The court is going to take a brief recess.